Chapter 8. Transubstantiation of a Poor White. How Andrew Johnson, unexpectedly raised to the presidency, was suddenly set between a democracy which included poor whites and black men, and an autocracy that included big business and slave barons, and how, torn between impossible allegiances, he ended in forcing a hesitant nation to choose between the increased political power of a restored Southern oligarchy and votes for Negroes. Like Nemesis of Greek tragedy, the central problem of America after the Civil War, as before, was the black man. Those 4 million souls whom the nation had used and degraded, and on whom the South had built an oligarchy similar to the colonial imperialism of today, erected on cheap colored labor and raising raw material for manufacture. If Northern industry before the war had secured a monopoly of the raw material raised in the South for its new manufactures, and if Northern and Western labor could have maintained their wage scale against slave competition, the North would not have touched the slave system. But this the South had frustrated. It had threatened labor with nationwide slave competition, and had sent its cotton abroad to buy cheap manufactures, and had resisted the protective tariff demanded by the North. It was this specific situation that had given the voice of freedom a chance to be heard. Freedom for new-come peasants who feared the competition of slave labor. Peasants from Europe, New England, and the poor white South. Freedom for all men black and white through that dream of democracy in which the best of the nation still believed. The result was war, because of the moral wrong, the economic disaster, and the democratic contradiction of making human labor real estate. War, because the South was determined to make free white labor compete with black slaves, monopolize land and raw material in the hands of a political aristocracy, and extend the scope of that power. War, because the industrial North refused to surrender its raw material and one of its chief markets to Europe. War, because white American labor, while it refused to recognize black labor as equal and human, had to fight to maintain its own humanity and ideal of equality. The result of the war left 4 million human beings just as valuable for the production of cotton and sugar as they had been before the war, but during the war, as laborers and soldiers, these Negroes had made it possible for the North to win, and without their actual and possible aid, the South would never have surrendered. And not least, these 4 million free men formed in the end the only possible moral justification for an otherwise sordid and selfish orgy of murder, arson, and theft. Now, early in 1865, the war is over. The North does not especially want free Negroes. It wants trade with wealth. The South does not want a particular interpretation of the Constitution. It wants cheap Negro labor and the political and social power based on it. Had there been no Negroes, there would have been no war. Had no Negroes survived the war, peace would have been difficult because of hatred, loss, and bitter grief. But its logical path would have been straight. The South would have returned to its place in Congress with less than its former representation because of the growing North and West. These areas of growing manufacture and agriculture, railroad building, and corporations would have held the political power over the South until the South united with the new insurgency of the West or the old Eastern democratic ideals. Industrialization might have even brought a third party representing labor and raised the proletariat to dominance. Of this, in 1865, there were only vague signs, and in any case, the former Southern aristocracy would not easily have allied itself with immigrant labor, while the Southern poor whites would have needed long experience and teaching. Thus, the North, in the absence of the Negro, would have had a vast debt, a problem of charity, distress, and relief, such reasonable amnesty as would prevent the old Southern leaders from returning immediately to power, the recognition of the reorganized states, and then work and forgetting. Let us have peace. But there was the black man, looming like a dark ghost on the horizon. He was the child of force, and greed, and the father of wealth and war. His labor was indispensable, and the loss of it would have cost many times the cost of the war. If the Negro had been silent, his very presence would have announced his plight. He was not silent. He was in unusual evidence. He was writing petitions, making speeches, parading with returned soldiers, reciting his adventures as slave and freeman. Even dumb and still, he must be noticed. His poverty had to be relieved, and emancipation in his case had to mean poverty. If he had to work, he had to have land and tools. If his labor was in reality to be free labor, he had to have legal freedom and civil rights. His ignorance could only be removed by that very education which the law of the South had long denied him and the custom of the North had made exceedingly difficult. Thus, civil status and legal freedom, food, clothes, and tools, access to land and help to education were the minimum demands of 4 million laborers, and these demands no man could ignore. Northerner or Southerner, abolitionist or copperhead, laborer or captain of industry. How did the nation face this paradox and dilemma? Led by Abraham Lincoln, the nation had looked back to the status before the war in order to find a path to which the new nation and the new condition of the freedmen could be guided. Only one forward step President Lincoln insisted upon, and that was the real continued freedom of the emancipated slave. But the abolition democracy went beyond this because it was convinced that here was no logical stopping place, and it looked forward to civil and political rights, education and land, as the only complete guarantee of freedom in the face of a dominant South which hoped from the first to abolish slavery only in name. In the North, a new and tremendous dictatorship of capital was arising. There was only one way to curb and direct what promised to become the greatest plutocratic government which the world had ever known. This way was first to implement public opinion by the weapon of universal suffrage, a weapon which the nation already had in part, but which had been virtually impotent in the South because of slavery, and which was at least weakened in the North by the disfranchisement of an unending mass of foreign-born laborers. Once universal suffrage was achieved, the next step was to use it with such intelligence and power that it would function in the interest of the mass of working men. To accomplish this end, there should have been in the country and represented in Congress a union between the champions of universal suffrage and the rights of freedmen, together with the leaders of labor, the small landholders of the West, and, logically, the poor whites of the South. Against these would have been arrayed the Northern industrial oligarchy, and eventually, when they were readmitted to Congress, the representatives of the former Southern oligarchy. This union of democratic forces never took place. On the contrary, they were torn apart by artificial lines of division. The old anti-Negro labor rivalry between white and black workers kept the labor elements after the war from ever really uniting in a demand to increase labor power by Negro suffrage and Negro economic stability. The West was seduced from a vision of peasant proprietors, recruited from a laboring class, into a vision of labor-exploiting farmers and land speculation, which tended to transform the Western farmers into a petty bourgeoisie, fighting not to overcome but to share spoils with the large land speculators, the monopolists of transportation, and the financiers. Wherever a liberal and democratic party started to differentiate itself from this group, the only alliance offered was the broken oligarchy of the South, with its determination to re-enslave Negro labor. The effective combination which ensued was both curious and contradictory. The masters of industry, the financiers and monopolists, had in self-defense to join with abolition democracy in forcing universal suffrage on the South, or submit to the reassertion of the old land-slave feudalism with increased political power. Such a situation demanded an economic guardianship of freedmen, and the first step to this meant at least the beginning of a dictatorship by labor. This, however, had to be but temporary union, and was bound to break up before long. The break was begun by the extraordinary corruption, graft, and theft that became more and more evident in the country from 1868 on, as a result of the wild idea that industry and progress for the people of the United States were compatible with the selfish sequestration of profit for private individuals and powerful corporations. But those who revolted from the party of exploitation and high finance did not see allies in the dictatorship of labor in the South. Rather, they were entirely misled by the complaint of property from the Southern oligarchy. They failed to become a real party of economic reform and became a reaction of small property holders against corporations, of a petty bourgeoisie against a new economic monarchy. They immediately joined big business in coming to an understanding with the South in 1876, so that by force and fraud, the South overthrew the dictatorship of the workers. But this was only the immediate cause. If there had been no widespread political corruption, North and South, there would still have arisen an absolute difference between those who were trying to conduct the new Southern state governments in the interest of the mass of laborers, black and white, and those North and South who were determined to exploit labor, both in agriculture and industry, for the benefit of an oligarchy. Such an oligarchy was in effect back of the military dictatorship which supported these very Southern labor governments, and which had to support them either as laborers or by developing among them a capitalist class. But as soon as there was understanding between the Southern exploiter of labor and the Northern exploiter, this military support would be withdrawn, and the labor governments, in spite of what they had accomplished for the education of the masses, and in spite of the movements against waste and graft which they had inaugurated, would fail. Under such circumstances, they had to fail, and in a large sense, the immediate hope of American democracy failed with them. Let us now follow this development more in detail. In 1863 and 1864, Abraham Lincoln had made his tentative proposals for reconstructing the South. He had left many things unsaid. The loyal-minded consisting of a few, as one-tenth of the voters whom Lincoln proposed to regard as a state, must naturally, to survive, be supported by the United States Army, until a majority of the inhabitants acquiesced in the new arrangements. It was Lincoln's fond hope that this acquiescence might be swift and clear, but no one knew better than he that it might not. He was careful to say that Congress would certainly have voice as to the terms on which they would recognize the newly elected senators and representatives. This proposal met the general approval of the country, but Congress saw danger and enacted the Wade Davis Bill. This did not recognize Negro suffrage and was not radically different from the Lincoln plan, except that the final power and assent of Congress were more prominently set forth. Lincoln did not oppose it. He simply did not want his hands permanently tied. The bill failed, leaving Lincoln making a careful study of the situation and promising another statement. He was going forward carefully, hoping for some liberal movement to show itself in the South and delicately urging it. In the election of 1864, the country stood squarely back of him. The Northern Democracy carried only New Jersey, Delaware, and Kentucky. But he died, and Andrew Johnson took his place. Thus, suddenly, April 15, 1865, Andrew Johnson found himself President of the United States. 6 days after Lee's surrender, and a month and a half after the 38th Congress had adjourned, March 3rd. It was the drear destiny of the poor white South that, deserting its economic class and itself, it became the instrument by which democracy in the nation was done to death, race provincialism deified, and the world delivered to plutocracy. The man who led the way with unconscious paradox and contradiction was Andrew Johnson. Lately, the early life and character of Andrew Johnson have been abundantly studied. He was a fanatical hater of aristocracy. Through every public act of his runs one consistent, unifying thread of purpose: the advancement of the power, prosperity, and liberty of the masses at the expense of entrenched privilege. The slaveholding aristocracy he hated with a bitter, enduring hatred born of envy and ambition. "If Johnson were a snake," said his rival, the well-born Isham G. Harris, "he would lie in the grass to bite the heels of the rich men's children." The very thought of an aristocrat caused him to emit venom and lash about him in fury. His political methods were those of the barnstorming demagogue. Johnson's speeches were tissues of misstatement, misrepresentation, and insulting personalities directed to the passions and unreasoning impulses of the ignorant voters. Assaults upon aristocrats, combined with vaunting of his own low origin and the dignity of manual labor. Yet a biographer says that Johnson was the only president who practiced what he preached, drawing no distinction between rich and poor or high and low. Do not these facts furnish an explanation of Johnson's life? Do they not show why he had the courage to go up against caste and cheap aristocracy, why he dared to stand for the underdog, whether Catholic, Hebrew, foreigner, mechanic, or child, and to cling like death to the old flag and the Union? "Gladly I would lay down my life," he wrote, "if I could so engraft democracy into our general government that it would be permanent." To all this, there is one great qualification. Andrew Johnson could not include Negroes in any conceivable democracy. He tried to, but as a poor white, steeped in the limitations, prejudices, and ambitions of his social class, he could not. And this is the key to his career. Johnson sat in Congress from 1843 to 1853 and was senator from 1857 to 1862. He favored the annexation of Texas as a gateway for Negro immigration. He was against a high tariff, championed free Western lands for white labor, and favored the annexation of Cuba for black slave labor. McConnell introduced a homestead bill into Congress in January 1846. Johnson's bill came in March. He returned to Tennessee as governor, but induced the legislature to instruct members of Congress to vote for his bill. The bill finally passed the House, but was defeated in the Senate, and this was repeated for several sessions. Meantime, Johnson found himself in curious company. He was linked, on the one hand, to the Free Soilers, and in 1851 went to New York to address a land reform association. On the other hand, the South called him socialistic, and Wigfall of Texas dubbed him the vilest of Republicans, the reddest of Reds, a sans culotte. For 4 years past, he has been trying to please the North with his homestead and other bills. The abolitionists, meanwhile, looked askance, because Johnson favored the bill for annexing Cuba. He voted against the Pacific Railroad, owned 8 slaves, and said at one time, "You won't get rid of the Negro except by holding him in slavery." In the midst of such vacillation and contradiction, small wonder that Lane referred to Johnson's triumphant ignorance and exulting stupidity. Yet Johnson hewed doggedly to certain lines. In 1860, he was advocating his homestead bill again. It finally passed both House and Senate, but Buchanan vetoed it as unconstitutional. Johnson called the message monstrous and absurd. At last, in June 1862, after the South had withdrawn from Congress, Johnson's bill was passed, and Lincoln signed it. Yet it was this same Johnson who said in the 36th Congress that if the abolitionists freed the slaves and let them loose on the South, the non-slaveholder would join with the slave owner and extirpate them, and if one should be more ready to join than another, it would be myself. Johnson early became a follower of Hinton Helper and used his figures. The impending crisis was Andrew Johnson's vade mecum, his arsenal of facts. Johnson made 2 violent speeches against secession in 1860-1861, with bitter personalities against Jefferson Davis, Judah Benjamin, and their fellows. He called them rebels and traitors. The galleries yelled, and the presiding officers threatened to clear them. Johnson shouted, "I would have them arrested, and if convicted, within the meaning and scope of the Constitution, by the eternal God, I would execute them. Sir, treason must be punished. Its enormity and the extent and depth of the offense must be made known." Klingman of North Carolina said that Johnson's speech brought on the Civil War. Alexander Stephens said that it solidified the North. Letters came in to congratulate and to encourage the only Union senator from the South. Labor rallied to him. A Baltimore laborer wrote that the poor working man will no doubt be called on to fight the battles of the rich. From Memphis, another wrote, "It was labor that achieved our independence, and the laborers are ready to maintain it." The New York Working Men's Association passed a resolution of thanks. Lincoln set about winning Tennessee, and as a step toward it, asked Andrew Johnson to go and act as military governor and restore the state. Johnson resigned from the Senate and went to Tennessee early in March 1862. He arrived in Nashville March 12th and took possession of the state house. His courage and sacrifice eventually redeemed the state and restored it to the Union. Several times Johnson spoke on slavery and the Negro when he asked that plantations be divided in the South and lands opened in the West. He had in mind white men who would thus become rich, or at least richer. But for Negroes, he had nothing of the sort in mind, except the bare possibility that, if given freedom, they might continue to exist and not die out. Johnson said in January 1864 at Nashville, in reply to a question as to whether he was in favor of emancipation, "As for the Negro, I am for setting him free, but at the same time, I assert that this is a white man's government. If whites and blacks can get along together, arrangements must be made to colonize the blacks." In 1843, when I was candidate for governor, it was said, "That fellow Johnson is a demagogue, is a abolitionist," because I advocated a white basis for representation, apportioning members of Congress according to the number of qualified voters, instead of embracing Negroes. They called me an abolitionist. What do we find today? Right goes forward. Truth triumphs. Justice is supreme, and slavery goes down. In fact, the Negroes are emancipated in Tennessee today, and the only remaining question for us to settle, as prudent and wise men, is in assigning the Negro his new relation. Now, what will that be? The Negro will be thrown upon society, governed by the same laws that govern communities, and be compelled to fall back upon his own resources as all other human beings are. Political freedom means liberty to work, and at the same time enjoy the products of one's labor. If he can rise by his own energies, in the name of God, let him rise. In saying this, I do not argue that the Negro race is equal to the Anglo-Saxon. If the Negro is better fitted for the inferior condition of society, the laws of nature will assign him there. As a reward for Johnson's services and to unite the sections, Lincoln chose Johnson as his running mate in 1864. Before the campaign, June 10th, from the St. Cloud Hotel, Johnson gave his philosophy of Reconstruction. "One of the chief elements of this rebellion is the opposition of the slave aristocracy to being ruled by men who have risen from the ranks of the people. This aristocracy hated Mr. Lincoln because he was of humble origin, a rail splitter in early life. One of them, the private secretary of Howell Cobb, said to me one day, after a long conversation, 'We people of the South will not submit to be governed by a man who has come up from the ranks of the common people as Abe Lincoln has.' He uttered the essential feeling and spirit of this Southern rebellion. Now, it has just occurred to me, if this aristocracy is so violently opposed to being governed by Mr. Lincoln, what in the name of conscience will it do with Lincoln and Johnson? I am for emancipation for two reasons. First, because it is right in itself. And second, because in the emancipation of the slaves, we break down an odious and dangerous aristocracy. I think that we are freeing more whites than blacks in Tennessee. I want to see slavery broken up and when its barriers are torn down, I want to see industrious, thrifty immigrants pouring in from all parts of the country. Come on! We need your labor, your skill, your capital. Ah! These rebel leaders have a strong personal reason for holding out, to save their necks from the halter. And these leaders must feel the power of the government. Treason must be made odious, and the traitor must be punished and impoverished. Their great plantations must be seized and divided into small farms and sold to honest, industrious men. The day for protecting the lands and Negroes of these authors of rebellion is past. It is high time it was. During the campaign, he addressed a torchlight procession of thousands of Negroes and whites. He said, October 1864, "Who has not heard of the great estates of Mac Cockrell, situated near this city? Estates whose acres are numbered by the thousand, whose slaves were once counted by the score, and of Mac Cockrell, their possessor, the great slave owner, and, of course, the leading rebel, who lives in the very wantonness of wealth, wrung from the sweat and toil and stolen wages of others, and who gave fabulous sums to aid Jeff Davis in overturning this government. Who has not heard of the princely estates of General W.D. Harding, who by means of his property alone outweighed in influence any other man in Tennessee, no matter what were that other's worth, or wisdom, or ability? Harding, too, early espoused the cause of treason, and made it his boast that he had contributed and directly induced others to contribute millions of dollars in aid of that unholy cause. It is wrong that Mac Cockrell and W.D. Harding, by means of forced and unpaid labor, should have monopolized so large a share of the lands and wealth of Tennessee. And I say, if their immense plantations were divided up and parceled out amongst a number of free, industrious, and honest farmers, it would give more good citizens to the Commonwealth, increase the wages of our mechanics, enrich the markets of our city, enliven all the arteries of trade, improve society, and conduce to the greatness and glory of the state. The representatives of this corrupt, and if you will permit me almost to swear a little, this damnable aristocracy, taunt us with our desire to see justice done, and charge us with favoring Negro equality. Of all living men, they should be the last to mouth that phrase. And even when uttered in their hearing, it should cause their cheeks to tinge and burn with shame. Negro equality, indeed. Why, pass any day along the sidewalks of High Street where these aristocrats more particularly dwell, these aristocrats whose sons are now in the bands of guerrillas and cutthroats who prowl and rob and murder around our city. Pass by their dwellings, I say, and you will see as many mulatto as Negro children, the former bearing an unmistakable resemblance to their aristocratic owners. Thank God the war has ended all this. A war that has freed more whites than blacks. Suppose the Negro is set free, and we have less cotton. We will raise more wool, hemp, flax, and silk. It is all an idea that the world can't get along without cotton. And, as is suggested by my friend behind me, whether we attain perfection in the raising of cotton or not, I think we ought to stimulate the cultivation of hemp. Great and renewed laughter. For we ought to have more of it, and a far better material, a stronger fiber with which to make a stronger rope. For not to be malicious or malignant, I am free to say that I believe many who were driven into this rebellion are repentant. But I say of the leaders, the instigators, the conscious, intelligent traitors, they ought to be hung. Looking at this vast crowd of colored people, continued the governor, and reflecting through what a storm of persecution and obloquy they are compelled to pass, I am almost induced to wish that as in the days of old, a Moses might arise, who should lead them safely to their promised land of freedom and happiness. "You are our Moses!" shouted several voices, and the exclamation was caught up and cheered until the Capitol rung again. "Well, then," replied the speaker, "humble and unworthy as I am, if no other better shall be found, I will indeed be your Moses and lead you through the Red Sea of war and bondage to a fairer future of liberty and peace. I speak now as one who feels the world his country, and all who love equal rights his friends. I speak, too, as a citizen of Tennessee. I am here on my own soil, and here I mean to stay and fight this great battle of truth and justice to a triumphant end. Rebellion and slavery shall, by God's good help, no longer pollute our state. Loyal men, whether white or black, shall alone control her destinies. And when this strife in which we are all engaged is past, I trust, I know, we shall have a better state of things, and shall all rejoice that honest labor reaps the fruit of its own industry, and that every man has a fair chance in the race of life." Winston interpreted the latter part of this speech as directed to the whites, when clearly he was speaking directly to the colored people, but he was afterward unwilling to live up to its promises. As a matter of fact, he favored emancipation in order to save the Union and to free the white man, and no further. "Damn the Negroes," he once said, when charged with race equality, "I am fighting those traitorous aristocrats, their masters." Johnson appeared to take the oath of office as vice president, so drunk he was taken into prolonged seclusion after a maudlin speech. His resignation was discussed. He was not a habitual drunkard, although he drank 3 or 4 glasses of Robertson's Canada whiskey some days. In 1848, Johnson writes that he had been on a kind of bust, not a big drunk. Both of Johnson's sons became drunkards and were cut off before they reached middle life. Yet Lincoln was right. "Oh, well, don't you bother about Andy Johnson's drinking. He made a bad slip the other day, but I have known Andy a great many years, and he ain't no drunkard." Johnson was deeply humiliated by the inauguration episode, and perhaps here began his alienation from those who might have influenced him best. Charles A. Dana, Assistant Secretary of War, says that he met Vice President Johnson in Richmond. "He took me aside and spoke with great earnestness about the necessity of not taking the Confederates back without some conditions or without some punishment. He insisted that their sins had been enormous, and that if they were let back into the Union without any punishment, the effect would be very bad. He said they might be very dangerous in the future." The vice president talked to me in this strain for fully 20 minutes, I should think, an impassioned, earnest speech on the subject of punishing rebels. His sudden induction as president was marked by modesty and genuine feeling. Carl Schurz says that the inaugural speech of Andrew Johnson in 1865 was very pleasing to the liberals of the North and made them believe that he was going to allow the Negro to have some part in the reconstruction of the states. For a month after coming to the presidency, Johnson indulged in speech-making, and his words were still so severe that the anti-slavery people became uneasy, feeling that Johnson would give his attention primarily to punishing the whites, rather than protecting the Negroes. April 21, 1865, he said in an interview with some citizens of Indiana, "They, the rebel leaders, must not only be punished, but their social power must be destroyed. And I say that, after making treason odious, every Union man and the government should be remunerated out of the pockets of those who have inflicted this great suffering upon the country. This was exactly the thesis of Thaddeus Stevens, enunciated in September of the same year. A number of Virginians visited Johnson in July and complained that they were seeking credits in the North and West, but could get no consideration while they remained under the ban of the government. The president replied, "It was the wealthy men who dragooned the people into secession. I know how this thing was done. You rich men used the press and bullied your little men to force the state into secession." He spoke as a poor white, for poor whites, and the planters left in gloom. He kept on insisting upon punishment for the South, and not only personal punishment, but economic punishment, so that many conservatives were afraid that they had elected to the presidency a radical who would seriously attack the South. This would have been true, but for one thing. The Southern poor white, and his attitude toward property and income, seriously modified by the presence of the Negro. Even Abraham Lincoln was unable for a long time to conceive of free, poor black citizens as voters in the United States. The problem of the Negroes, as he faced it, worried him, and he made repeated efforts to see if, in some way, they could not be sent off to Africa or to foreign lands. Johnson had no such broad outlook. Negroes to him were just Negroes, and even as he expressed his radical ideas of helping the poor Southerners, he seldom envisaged Negroes as a part of the poor. Lincoln came to know Negroes personally. He came to recognize their manhood. He praised them generously as soldiers and suggested that they be admitted to the ballot. Johnson, on the contrary, could never regard Negroes as men. "He has all the narrowness and ignorance of a certain class of whites who have always looked upon the colored race as out of the pale of humanity." The Northern press had been quite satisfied with Lincoln's attitude. He had served liberty and America well. "Lincoln," said Senator Doolittle, representing industry in the West, "would have dealt with the rebels as an indulgent father deals with his erring children. Johnson would deal with them more like a stern and incorruptible judge. Thus, in a moment, has the scepter of power passed from the hand of flesh to the hand of iron." At a cabinet meeting with Mr. Lincoln on the last day of his life, Friday, April 14th, Stanton submitted the draft of a plan for the restoration of governments in the South. The draft applied expressly to two states, but was intended as a model for others. The president suggested a revision, and the subject was postponed until Tuesday, the 18th. Andrew Johnson became president, and on Sunday, April 16th, Stanton read his draft to Sumner and other gentlemen. Sumner interrupted the reading with the inquiry, "Whether any provision was made for enfranchising the colored men," saying, also, "that unless the black man is given the right to vote, his freedom is a mockery." Stanton deprecated the agitation of the subject, but Sumner insisted that the black man's right to vote was the essence, the great essential. Stanton's draft, now confined to North Carolina, was considered in the cabinet May 9th, when it appeared with a provision for suffrage in the election of members of a constitutional convention for the state. It included the loyal citizens of the United States. This paragraph, it appears, Stanton had accepted April 16th, as an amendment from Sumner and Colfax. He admitted that it was intended to include Negroes as well as white men. Stanton invited an expression of opinion. Several members of the cabinet were absent. Stanton, Dennison, and Speed favored the inclusion. McCulloch, Wells, and Usher were against it. The president expressed no opinion, but Sumner was certain of the president's decision in favor of Negro suffrage. Sumner sought to keep close to Johnson. He and Chase had an interview with him a week after he had taken the oath of office. Johnson was reserved but sympathetic, and they left lighthearted. A few days later, when the president and Senator Sumner were alone together, the president said, "On this question, that of suffrage, there is no difference between us. You and I are alike." Sumner expressed his joy and gratitude that the president had taken this position and that, as a consequence, there would thus be no division in the Union Party. And the president replied, "I mean to keep you all together." As he walked away that evening, Sumner felt that the battle of his own life was ended. He wrote to Bright, May 1, 1865, encouragingly, "Last evening I had a long conversation with him, Johnson, mainly on the rebel states, and how they shall be tranquilized. Of course, my theme is justice to the colored race. He accepted this idea completely, and indeed went so far as to say that there is no difference between us. You understand that the question whether rebel states shall be treated as military provinces or territories is simply one of form, with a view to the great result. It is the result that I aim at, and I shall never stickle on any intermediate question if that is secured." He deprecates haste, is unwilling that states should be precipitated back, thinks there must be a period of probation, but that meanwhile all loyal people, without distinction of color, must be treated as citizens and must take part in any proceedings for reorganization. He doubts at present the expediency of announcing this from Washington, lest it should give a handle to party, but is willing it should be made known to the people in the rebel states. The Chief Justice started yesterday on a visit to North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, and New Orleans, and will, on his way, touch the necessary strings, so far as he can. I anticipate much from this journey. His opinions are fixed, and he is well informed with regard to those of the President. I would not be too sanguine, but I should not be surprised if we had this great question settled before the next meeting of Congress. I mean by this that we had such expression of opinion and acts as will forever conclude it. My confidence is founded in part upon the essential justice of our aims and the necessity of the case. With the President as well disposed as he shows himself, and the Chief Justice as positive, we must prevail. Will not all this sanctify our war beyond any in history? The next day, writing to Lieber, Sumner quoted Johnson as saying that colored persons are to have the right to suffrage, that no state can be precipitated into the Union, that rebel states must go through a term of probation. All this he had said to me before. 10 days ago, the Chief Justice and myself visited him in the evening to speak of these things. I was charmed by his sympathy, which was entirely different from his predecessor's. The Chief Justice is authorized to say wherever he is what the President desires, and to do everything he can to promote organization without distinction of color. The President desires that the movement should appear to proceed from the people. This is in conformity with his general ideas, but he thinks it will disarm the party at home. I told him that while I doubted if the work could be effectively done without federal authority, I regarded the modus operandi as an inferior question, and that I should be content, provided equality before the law was secured for all without distinction of color. I said during this winter that the rebel states could not come back except on the footing of the Declaration of Independence and the complete recognition of human rights. I feel more than ever confident that all this will be fulfilled. And then what a regenerated land! I had looked for a bitter contest on this question, but with the President on our side, it will be carried by simple avoirdupois. Chase wrote Johnson from South Carolina the same month. Suffrage to loyal blacks. I find that readiness and even desire for it is in proportion to the loyalty of those who express opinions. Nobody dissents vehemently, while those who have suffered from rebellion and rejoice with their whole hearts in the restoration of the national authority are fast coming to the conclusion that they will find their own surest safety in the proposed extension. All seem embarrassed about first steps. I do not entertain the slightest doubt that they would all welcome some simple recommendation from yourself, and would adopt readily any plan which you would suggest. I am anxious that you should have the lead in this work. It is my deliberate judgment that nothing will so strengthen you with the people or bring so much honor to your name throughout the world as some such short address as I suggested before leaving Washington. Just say to the people, reorganize your state governments. I will aid you in the enrollment of the loyal citizens. You will not expect me to discriminate among men equally loyal. Once enrolled, vote for delegates to the convention to reform your state constitution. I will aid you in collecting and declaring their suffrages. Your convention and yourselves must do the rest, but you may count on the support of the national government in all things constitutionally expedient. In April and May of 1866, Tennessee had confined the right to vote to whites. The Tennessee Senate refused a suffrage bill, which allowed all blacks and whites of legal age to vote, but excluded, after 1875, all who could not read. Sumner wanted Johnson to insist on Negro suffrage in Tennessee, but Johnson explained that if he were in Tennessee, he would take a stand, but that he could not in Washington. Sumner remained in Washington half through May and saw the president almost daily, always seizing opportunity to present his views on Reconstruction and insisting on suffrage for Negroes. Just before leaving Washington, Sumner had a final interview with the president. He found him cordial and apparently unchanged. Sumner apologized for repeating his views expressed before. Johnson said with a smile, "Have I not always listened to you?" Sumner, as he left, assured his friends and correspondents that the cause he had at heart was safe, with Andrew Johnson. Disturbing signs, however, began to occur. Carl Schurz wrote in May concerning the plans of Southern leaders in Mississippi, Georgia, and North Carolina. Thaddeus Stevens was alarmed at the president's recognition of the Pierpont government of Virginia. A caucus was therefore called at the National Hotel at Washington, May 12th, to prevent the administration from going completely astray. Wade and Sumner said the president was in no danger, but that he was in favor of Negro suffrage. Sumner may have been over-sanguine and read into Johnson's words more than Johnson intended, but it is certain that Sumner received a definite understanding that President Johnson stood for real emancipation and Negro suffrage. Here, then, was Andrew Johnson in 1865, born at the bottom of society and during his early life a radical defender of the poor, the landless, and the exploited. In the heyday of his early political career, he railed against land monopoly in the South, and after the Civil War, wanted the land of the monopolists divided among peasant proprietors. Suddenly, by the weird magic of history, he becomes military dictator of a nation. He becomes a man by whom the greatest moral and economic revolution that ever took place in the United States, and perhaps in modern times, was to be put into effect. He becomes the real emancipator of 4 millions of black slaves who have suffered more than anything that he had experienced in his earlier days. They not only have no lands, they have not owned even their bodies, nor their clothes, nor their tools. They have been exploited down to the ownership of their own families. They have been poor by law and ignorant by force. What more splendid opportunity could the champion of labor and the exploited have had to start a nation towards freedom? Johnson took over Lincoln's cabinet with an anti-abolitionist Whig, a pro-slavery Democrat, and a liberal student of industry, among others. This cabinet lasted a little over a year when, early in July, 1866, three members, Dennison, Harlan, and Speed, resigned, being unwilling to oppose Congress. In all their logical sequence, the Reconstruction policies now associated with Johnson's name were laid down by Seward, and his logic overwhelmed Johnson. As Stevens explained, Seward entered into him, and ever since they have been running down steep places into the sea. The cabinet met at Seward's house May 9th, and on May 29th, Johnson issued a proclamation of amnesty, which showed the Seward influence. Indeed, nothing was left, apparently, of Johnson's liberalism except the exclusion from amnesty, not simply of the leaders of the Confederacy, but of the rich, those worth $20,000 or more. Seward opposed this, but it was the only thing that he yielded to Johnson's liberalism. He early convinced Johnson that Reconstruction was a matter for the president to settle, and especially he opened the door to his thorough conversion when the power of further pardons was put into Johnson's hand. Seward, who had remained secretary after Lincoln's death, had used all the powers of his persuasive eloquence to satisfy President Johnson that all now to be done was simply to restore the Union by at once readmitting the states lately in rebellion to their full constitutional functions as regular states of the Union, and that then, being encouraged by this mark of confidence, the late master class in the South could be trusted with the recognition and protection of the emancipated slaves. That Mr. Seward urged such advice upon the president, there is good reason for believing. Not only was it common report, but it accorded also strikingly with Mr. Seward's singular turn of mind concerning the slavery question. As after the outbreak of the secession movement, he peremptorily relegated the slavery question to the background, in spite of its evident importance in the Civil War and of the influence it would inevitably exercise upon the opinion and attitude of foreign nations, so he may have been forgetful of the national duty of honor to secure the rights of the freedmen and the safety of the Southern Union men in his impatient desire to restore the Union in point of form. Johnson was transformed. From the champion of peasant labor, he saw himself as the restorer of national unity and the benefactor and almsgiver to those very elements in the South which had formerly despised him. Of his real role as emancipator and the one who was to give effective freedom to Negroes, he still had not the slightest idea. He could not conceive of Negroes as men. And equally, he had no adequate idea of the industrial transformation that was going on in the North. There were, of course, the inevitable scars of the war, the loss of 1 million men and $12 billion in property, eventual pensions and indirect losses, the revolution in Southern agriculture, the universal lowering of ethical standards which always follows war. The West was uneasy on account of taxes, debt, and the money situation. In New York and Boston, men engaged in foreign commerce wanted speedy restoration of the South and a reduction in the tariff to increase their business. These complicated threads varied and changed as time went on, but when the 39th Congress met, the war business boom was still on. Failures had disappeared. Prices had increased. Wealth was being concentrated among the manufacturers, merchants, financiers, and speculators. There were great amounts of waiting capital, and all of these interests wanted the war stopped and the South restored. Sumner had not left Washington 10 days before his hopes for a just reconstruction on the basis of Negro suffrage were killed by the president's proclamation. Johnson's plan of reconstruction included the abolition of slavery, the repudiation of war debts, the nullification of secession ordinances, and the appointment of provisional governors to help in the reconstruction of civil government. Only those white folks who could take the loyal oath would take part in this reconstruction. In other words, this was practically Lincoln's plan, and it was also the Wade Davis plan, save that there was no open or expressed recognition of any power or function of Congress, except as judging the legality of elections. Johnson did not eventually even admit, as Lincoln apparently had agreed, that Congress was final judge as to whether these states could hold legal elections. Congress had adjourned before Lee's surrender, and it was widely believed that had Lincoln lived, a special session would have been summoned. The Seward-Johnson Compromise proposed not to call Congress. In one way, the decision was shrewd. It gave the administration 9 months to carry out its policy, and if the policy was successful, Congress would, when it met, be faced by a fait accompli, a nation at peace, a South restored with slavery abolished. What more could the nation want? On the other hand, the attempt was full of risk. Already the power of the executive had gone far beyond the dreams of living men. It must be curbed sooner or later. The military dictatorship which had carried on the war must, as soon as possible after the war, be tempered by democracy. The attempt to do even what the nation wanted without this was foolish. An attempt to override the will of the nation was suicidal, and yet that was precisely what Seward and Johnson eventually attempted. May 29th, the Declaration of Amnesty was issued, and that same month, provisional governors were appointed for North Carolina and Mississippi. In June, Georgia, Texas, Alabama, and South Carolina were given governors, and in July, Florida. Thus, 3 months after the assassination of Lincoln, Reconstruction was in operation. The Union Party divided in opinion. The Northern Democrats encouraged, and the South particularly encouraged. The South thereupon turned its attention on Johnson and brought to bear a second influence next in power to Seward's, and in the end exceeding it. Southern leaders descended upon the president, not simply the former slave barons, but new representatives of the poor whites. In less than 9 months after the proclamation of amnesty, 14,000 prominent persons are said to have received pardons from the president. No wonder the attitude of Johnson towards the South and the leaders of the rebellion was transformed. The very inferiority complex which made him hate the white planter concealed a secret admiration for his arrogance and address. Carl Schurz was coldly received when he returned from the southern trip which Johnson had urged upon him. Arrived at Washington, I reported myself at once at the White House. The president's private secretary, who seemed surprised to see me, announced me to the president, who sent out word that he was busy. When would it please the president to receive me? The private secretary could not tell, as the president's time was much occupied by urgent business. I left the anteroom, but called again the next morning. The president was still busy. I asked the private secretary to submit to the president that I had returned from a 3 months' journey made at the president's personal request, that I thought it my duty respectfully to report myself back, and that I should be obliged to the president if he would let me know whether, and if so, when, he would receive me to that end. The private secretary went in again and brought out the answer that the president would see me in an hour or so. At the appointed time, I was admitted. The president received me without a smile of welcome. His mien was sullen. I said that I had returned from the journey which I had made in obedience to his demand, and was ready to give him, in addition to the communications I had already sent him, such further information as was in my possession. A moment's silence followed. Then he inquired about my health. I thanked him for the inquiry and hoped the president's health was good. He said it was. Another pause, which I brought to an end by saying that I wished to supplement the letters I had written to him from the South with an elaborate report giving my experience and conclusions in a connected shape. The president looked up and said that I need not go to the trouble of writing out such a general report on his account. I replied that it would be no trouble at all, but I considered it a duty. The president did not answer. The silence became awkward, and I bowed myself out. President Johnson evidently wished to suppress my testimony as to the condition of things in the South. I resolved not to let him do so. I had conscientiously endeavored to see Southern conditions as they were. I had not permitted any political considerations or any preconceived opinions on my part to obscure my perception and discernment in the slightest degree. I had told the truth as I learned it, and I understood it with the severest accuracy, and I thought it due to the country that the truth be known. Among my friends in Washington, there were different opinions as to how the striking change in President Johnson's attitude had been brought about. Some told me that during the summer, the White House had been fairly besieged by Southern men and women of high social standing who had told the president that the only element of trouble in the South consisted in a lot of fanatical abolitionists who excited the Negroes with all sorts of dangerous notions, and that all would be well if he would only restore the Southern state governments as quickly as possible, according to his own plan as laid down in his North Carolina proclamation, and that he was a great man to whom they looked up as their savior. Now it was thought that Mr. Johnson, the plebeian who before the war had been treated with undisguised contempt by the slaveholding aristocracy, could not withstand the subtle flattery of the same aristocracy when they flocked around him as humble suppliants cajoling his vanity. In fact, personally, Johnson liked the slaveholders. He admired their manners. He enjoyed their carriage and clothes. They were quite naturally his ideal of what a gentleman should be. He could not help being tremendously flattered when they noticed him and actually sued for his favor. As compared with Northerners, he found them free, natural, and expansive, rather than cold, formal, and hypocritical. Johnson's change of mind during the last 10 days of May 1865 was probably due to the flatteries of Southern leaders, to the notice taken of his intoxication in the Senate by Sumner and others, to the counsels of Preston King and the Blairs, who sheltered him after that unfortunate exhibition, and above all to Seward. Johnson's program swung swiftly into its stride. Already, May 9th, the laws of the United States had been put in operation in Virginia and the Alexandria government thus recognized. Johnson recognized the Reconstruction already accomplished in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee, so that by midsummer, all the seceded states had been reconstructed under the Johnson Plan, except Texas. During the autumn, summer, and winter of 1865, elections for delegates to constitutional conventions were ordered in Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, on the basis of white suffrage. Before Congress met, these conventions had all passed ordinances repealing the secession ordinances or pronouncing them null and void. All except Mississippi and South Carolina had repudiated the Confederate debt. All had amended their constitutions abolishing slavery or recognizing its disappearance. State officers and representatives in Congress had been elected. Senators had also been chosen, except in Florida. All the states had adopted the 13th Amendment, except Florida and Mississippi. North Carolina had adopted the amendment with reservations. Florida adopted the amendment with reservations December 18th and elected senators. Against this suddenly marshaled and quickly executed plan of Johnson and his advisers, there was at the time no organized opposition. Congress was unquestionably determined to have the last word in the matter, but not decided as to what the word would be. The abolitionists wanted the freedom of the slaves guaranteed, and some of them saw Negro suffrage as the only method of accomplishing it, while still further recognized that a minimum of land and capital was absolutely necessary even to make the ballot effective. The majority of Northerners simply wanted to get rid of the question as quickly as possible. They were disposed to agree in the main with Johnson, but they were afraid that he was moving too fast, and that the South was returning to the Union without guarantees, either so far as the freedmen were concerned, or with regard to the problem of debt, the tariff, and national finance. Charles Sumner, representing the abolition democracy, agitated the question all summer. He brought up the matter on the streets, at dinner, and in society. He wrote his views for the Atlantic Monthly and had it in his speeches distributed widely. On June 21, 1865, there was a public meeting in Philadelphia on Negro suffrage, at which reports were read of reaction in the South. Sumner wrote to the members of Johnson's cabinet and urged them to change their course of action and not to follow the advice of Seward. But although 4 members of the cabinet were sympathetic, they took no action, and Sumner wrote to Lieber on August 11th. They were all courtiers, as if they were counselors of the king. Stevens, Davis, and Wade were in despair against an executive who had both military power and the power of patronage, and was as yet unmoved by any unity of opinion in the North. Moreover, it did not seem wise to make as yet a fight on the basis of Negro suffrage. Too few Northern people agreed with it. Most public men and journalists gave no support to Sumner's demand for Negro suffrage. The governor of Indiana denounced it. The governor of Massachusetts was sure of the president's honesty of purpose. The editor of the New York Evening Post advised against any coercive action by Congress in the matter of suffrage, and the New York Times stood absolutely against it. Is there no way to arrest the insane course of the president in reorganization? Asked Stevens in the summer of 1865. If something is not done, wrote Sumner, the president will be crowned king before Congress meets. The abolitionists opened a campaign to convert the North to Negro suffrage, carrying on a propaganda with the money of industry and the logic of abolition democracy. The speeches of Sumner, Kelly, Phillips, and Douglas on Negro suffrage were printed and sent broadcast. Stearns wrote, "I am distributing 10,000 copies to anti-slavery men in all the free states, but desiring to increase the number to 100,000 or more, invite you to aid in its circulation. He raised $50,000 in the fall of 1865 to send out 100,000 newspapers and 50,000 pamphlets a week, and himself printed between 20,000 and 40,000 copies of Sumner's Worcester speech, October 12, 1865. Later, the Schurz Report and his newspaper articles formed strong documents. Yet the conversion of public opinion in the United States to Negro citizenship and suffrage was long and difficult. There were harassing questions that presented themselves to the majority of people in the North. Could a government, by united and determined effort, raise the Negroes to full American citizenship? Of course it could, if they were men. But were they men? Even if they were men, was it good policy thus to raise a great new working, voting class? On this point, there was less open argument, but it lay in the minds of businessmen and influenced their outlook and action. Johnson sensed the trend toward Negro suffrage and, taking a leaf from Lincoln's book, sought to stem it. But Johnson's mind was not like Lincoln's. Lincoln moved forward to Negro suffrage. Johnson, alarmed, retreated to it. August 15th, he had wired to his nominee, Sharkey, provisional governor of Mississippi, "If you could extend the elective franchise to all persons of color who can read the Constitution of the United States in English and write their names, and to all persons of color who own real estate valued at not less than $250 and pay taxes thereon, you would completely disarm the adversary and set an example the other states will follow. This you can do with perfect safety, and you thus place the southern states, in reference to free persons of color, upon the same basis with the free states. I hope and trust your convention will do this, and as a consequence, the radicals, who are wild upon Negro franchise, will be completely foiled in their attempt to keep the southern states from renewing their relations to the Union by not accepting their senators and representatives." Blaine says that this advice was sent to other provisional governors, but nothing came of it, chiefly because Johnson did not insist, and his heart was not in the suggestion. Sumner's words showed that union between Northern industrialists and abolition democracy had been growing during the summer. After the autumn elections, Sumner sent a long telegram to President Johnson. On the Saturday evening before Congress met, he was with him 2 hours. He found him changed in temper and purpose, no longer sympathetic or even kindly, but harsh, petulant, and unreasonable.